best choice. So I've been here on faculty since 2004. So today I want to talk about, I want to focus on the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. I think medication management and how to manage Parkinson's disease is a talk all by itself. But I think what I want to talk about today is more about Parkinson's disease, about diagnosis. Just in terms of disclosures, I'm not connected with any pharmaceutical company. I am going to be talking fairly extensively about the Michael J. Fox Foundation study, and I'm the site investigator for that. And although this is not necessarily a conflict of interest, I'm on the FDA Peripheral and Central Advisory Committee, and we reviewed DaTscan, which I'm going to also be talking about. So I want to talk, it's always good to get everybody on the same page. I want to talk about the epidemiology of Parkinson's disease, and then focus on what I focus on in terms of the history and physical examination when someone is referred for Parkinsonism or possible Parkinson's disease. And then just to give you an idea in terms of how to track Parkinson's disease, I want to go into a little bit about how we rate it and how we follow Parkinson's disease. It's more than a global, you're better, you're not as good, we need to change things around. There are actually some specific measures that we look at. So I want to show you some examples of how we do that. And then finally, I want to finish with the Michael J. Fox Foundation study, the PPMI, or Parkinson's Progressive Markers Initiative study. James Parkinson described Parkinson's disease, who it was named after by Charcot, in his essay in 1817, so almost 200 years ago. And what he described was involuntary tremulous motion, so he recognized the tremor part of Parkinson's disease, with lessened muscular power, so people feel weak, although they may not necessarily be weak, they may not use their strength as well as they'd hope. In parts not in action, so in other words, it's mostly at rest, and even when supported, so a little bit of action tremor, with a propensity to bend the trunk forward, so he recognized the postural aspect as well, and to pass from a walking to a running pace, the senses and intellect being uninjured. Well, the last part isn't necessarily correct, but we added to that. And Charcot added rigidity 40 years later and named it after James Parkinson. So I want you to keep that description in mind, because that's still how, essentially, we diagnose Parkinson's disease. So almost 200 years later, we're using the same description and the same measures to diagnose and track it, and I think that there may be a difference in the future. Now, who gets Parkinson's disease? Now, I know that there are more famous people that have Parkinson's disease, but I like this slide because it's more men than women, which is the case. It can affect young, but it's a wide spectrum of disease. It is less common in blacks and Asians, although it can certainly affect that population, and I think that here at Boston Medical Center, we certainly see it in that population. I think it's just under-recognized in many cases. And head trauma may be a risk factor. Worldwide prevalence, it's about 1% of the population 65 and older. That's a pretty substantial portion of the population. It increases with age, and so it's about 3% of the population 85 and older. And so the worldwide prevalence is about 187 per 100,000. What does this translate to in North America? About 1 million people. And estimates range from 500,000 up to almost 2 million, but 1 million is about what the number that's most commonly thrown around. Annually, that means that there's about 50,000 new cases in the U.S. That are diagnosed. So this is a fairly common disease. As I said, it's more common in men than women at a substantial rate, about 2 to 1, and we don't understand why. This is still not clear, and I can tell you that there have been trials looking at estrogen in Parkinson's disease, and that was right around the time when estrogen therapy was associated with increased stroke and cardiovascular risk, so that was stopped early. As I said, it's less common in blacks and Asians. The average age of onset is in the early 60s, but there's a very wide range. Some people say that if it's under 30, it's not really Parkinson's disease, it's a similar disease, but it can be, there is a juvenile form of Parkinson's disease as well. That's exceedingly rare, though. But about 5 to 10% of people are 45 or younger. So it can affect younger individuals, although the vast majority are in their 60s and 70s. I just want to give some perspective worldwide what this is going to mean for us. So in the most populous nations, the population is going to double. In the most populous nations, will double in population from 4.3 million to 9.5 million worldwide. And so what this translates to in terms of Parkinson's disease is really unbelievable costs. And I know that we don't like to think about cost and medicine, but I think that it's been thrust in our face and we really have to think about this. But the combined direct and indirect cost of Parkinson's disease, if we think about the treatment, the direct treatment, the Social Security payments, lost income, right now is about $25 billion in the U.S. That's a, to me, I was shocked when I saw this one when it was published. It was actually Ray Dorsey that published it in 2007. And medication cost, again, this is a few years ago, is $2,500 annually. Surgery itself can cost $100,000. So even though it's only, in some populations, up to 5%, it's typically 1 or 2% of the Parkinson's disease population that gets surgery. If you think about a million people in the U.S. and 1% of them is getting surgery, that adds up fairly quickly. The other consideration is that if you look at people in long-term care settings, up to 7% of people have either Parkinson's disease or a Parkinsonism. So it can, and the medications and treatments are often overlapping. I want to show you just a brief video so that when we talk about the clinical aspects of Parkinson's disease, you can keep this in mind. So this is a gentleman who's had Parkinson's for about 5 years, and you can see that as he sits here after a couple seconds, the latency of the is one classic aspect. The tremor comes out in that right hand. It's a little bit in the left hand as well. And he's a bit slow, and I'm not going to show you all the different parts of the exam, but how to bring out different tremor, like in his chin when he does this, and he's pretty slow, and it's reduced amplitude when it comes to those finger taps. He can stand up pretty well. It's a little on the slow side, but it's a little slow. And when he walks, there's more tremor and no arm swing. When he turns, instead of leading with the shoulders, he turns everything at once. And he takes about a normal number of steps. So this is someone who's relatively early in terms of his symptoms of Parkinson's disease, even though he's been diagnosed for about 5 years. Just keep those little aspects in mind. How do we make the diagnosis today? It's really based on symptoms and exam findings. It's a clinical diagnosis. And we know that that clinical diagnosis and what symptoms you ask about and what signs you see on exam really depends on who you go to. There have been specific studies looking at this, and movement disorder neurologists pick up more Parkinson's disease than general neurologists, more than internists. So this is one study of sensitivity, and this was based in the UK, and I would argue that their exam skills are a bit better than ours. But what they looked at was the sensitivity of neurologists is about 93.5%, and non-specialists is 73.5%. So that's a pretty substantial difference in terms of sensitivity of a test, so to speak. And there are other studies to suggest that in the U.S., the sensitivity of general internists is about 50%, general neurologists is 80%, and movement disorder specialists is in about 95%. So it depends on the study, but I think these are the best numbers. So that's why I put those up there. Right now, there isn't a lab test, an MRI, CAT scan, PET scan, X-ray, or biopsy available, although sometimes we do some of these tests to make sure that someone doesn't have another disease that can make them look like they have Parkinsonism. So, for example, if someone comes in with lower extremity Parkinsonism and they have nothing cranially or in their arms, that's a classic finding for vascular Parkinsonism. That's someone, there's no question I'm going to get imaging on. I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about DAT scan because this is based on the advisory committee that I was on. The FDA actually approved this as a way to differentiate Parkinsonism from essential tremor, but it's going to be used in a lot of other ways as well. And we're looking at it, can we differentiate Parkinson's disease from other Parkinson-like disorders? I'm going to tell you a little bit more about DAT scan, but I want to just focus more on the clinical side of the criteria. I love to show this because it really summarizes so much of the literature up until 1999 about how we diagnose. And this includes the UK Brain Bank criteria. The Brain Bank is the gold standard. The UK Brain Bank took people, about 100 people with Parkinsonism and a clinical diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. And after they passed away, looked at their brains under the microscope and which ones had Parkinson's disease and which ones didn't, and what were the signs that were most suggestive, along with some of the other exclusionary criteria. So these are group A features characteristic of Parkinson's disease. Resting tremor, so not just any kind of tremor. People come in having hyperthyroidism, too much coffee. I've seen that so many times. And they say, I have Parkinson's disease. Look, I'm shaking. And no, it's got to be a resting tremor. bradykinesia. And bradykinesia is the core sign that you have to have in order to even meet Parkinsonism. Now, this is very difficult because an 80-year-old is going to have less spontaneous movements and less overall movements than a 20-year-old. So how do you judge bradykinesia? And that can be very difficult sometimes. But you can certainly pick up some bradykinesia. Rigidity, and sometimes it can be very subtle. And you have to do different tricks to bring it out. And asymmetric onset. So Parkinson's disease almost always starts on one side of the body. Doesn't matter what handedness you are, although sometimes it's picked up a little early if you're right-handed and it starts in the right hand because people notice the problems that way. Now, if you have two of these four, you have possible Parkinson's disease. Three of these four, you have probable Parkinson's disease. The only way that you have definite is to look at the brain under the microscope. And I hope we're not going to be doing that with most of our patients. Group B features is suggestive of alternative diagnosis. So when I'm getting a history, this is what I'm really getting at. These are the features that I want to make sure someone doesn't have. Features unusual early in the clinical course. So I want to emphasize early. So prominent postural instability. So whenever people think about Parkinson's disease, they think about gait problems and falling and postural instability. But if it's within the first 3 years after symptom onset, that's a big clue. It's not Parkinson's disease. That's something, that's another disorder. You know, if someone slips on the ice once in 3 years, I don't call that prominent falling. If someone comes in and they've broken three different bones in three different areas of their body, that's significant falls. And that leads me to go down a different path rather than Parkinson's disease. So prominent postural instability within the first 3 years is a major, major clue. Freezing phenomenon and freezing, people don't, you know, if you say, do you have freezing, they're not going to know what you're talking about. But what people do is they're walking along, and as they approach a door or a window, they kind of do this. Smaller and smaller steps until they get stuck. That's freezing. I love being movement disordered because I can demonstrate a lot what I see. So hallucinations, not related to medications. And so when I see someone for the first time before they're on any medications, it's so key to ask about hallucinations because they're not going to tell you. They're not going to say, well, I kind of see a cat in the house. Or I see a pattern on the wall at nighttime when I know there's not a pattern there. Or I had one patient who saw a telephone cord that when the lighting was just right, he would see it swing or move or turn into a snake. And so people can have illusions or hallucinations that are there that they may not tell you about. They're not necessarily scary. They just kind of shrug them off. So you have to specifically ask about it. And if they have hallucinations or dementia, which is the next one, within the first year or within the first year of the diagnosis or within a year of their symptoms, that's, again, a big clue. It's not Parkinson's disease. Perhaps it's something else. Supranuclear gaze palsy. So, of course, this is getting at progressive supranuclear gaze palsy. And you're going to usually pick this up when it comes to the postural instability because these are the people that come in with broken bones. But to me, this highlights a point that the eyes are the window to the brain in many, many ways. It's the only nerve in the body you can see, so fundoscopic exam is so important. But when it comes to movement disorders, it's really watching how the eyes move. And a lot of times people do pursuits side to side, and that's about it. But what's more important to me are the saccades, the quick point-to-point movements. Look to the right, look to the left. And that you can pick up so much more abnormalities that with the quick point-to-point movements than with the smooth pursuits. And in progressive supranuclear gaze palsy, it's vertical as well. So it's the vertical eye movements with the saccades that often get missed because people do pursuits side to side. They say eye movements are normal, and then they're done. But there's a lot more to eye movements. Severe symptomatic dysautonomia not related to medications. That can be a clue of multiple systems atrophy. And then there's kind of a, well, anything that could give Parkinsonism. And there's a list of 100 medications, no more pressure hydrocephalus. There's a number of other things, and I'm going to show you a partial list as well. So again, you want to ask about the progression of the symptoms. How fast are things going on? So the gentleman that I showed you, he'd been diagnosed for 5 years, but really had things been going on for 9 years. And so that's not an unusual progression of symptoms. If someone says, yeah, I had tremor when I was a teenager, and they're coming to see you when they're 80, that's not Parkinson's disease. Right there, that tells you it's a much slower progression, and it's more likely to be a central tremor. Falls, functional assessment, to me, you know, we always, the neurologists think about grade 4 strength, grade 5 strength. You know, the formal 0 to 5 scale that was based on polio, which to me is important to document. But what's more important is, can they get their hands above their head? Can they do buttons? Can they do belt buckles? Tie their shoes? Can they bend down to pick something up? Can they get in and out of their car? So a functional assessment, to me, is much more important than the formal strength assessment. And this is part of the history that I get. Medication exposure. There's still a myth out there that a lot of the atypicals don't cause Parkinsonism, specifically risperidone. And I will tell you, I've seen every single neuroleptic, except for Seroquel and Clozaril, cause Parkinsonism. So those are the two exceptions. Everything else, I have seen Parkinsonism. So that's very important. And people don't think about metoclopramide. The other, I've seen one case of Thorazine-induced Parkinsonism, not because they were on Thorazine for any psychotic issue, but because of frequent hiccups. So that's also, I always ask about that. And what was the old blood pressure medication? Reserpine. Reserpine. I've seen two cases of reserpine-induced Parkinsonism. I don't even know, is reserpine on the market? I don't know either, but I've seen two cases of reserpine-induced Parkinsonism, but I haven't seen that in probably 6 or 7 years. Exposure to well water, manganese, and carbon monoxide. These are some of the toxic exposures that we think may be predisposed to Parkinsonism, certainly carbon monoxide. Manganese is more in minors, and well water is lifelong exposure. And it may be related to the pesticides or other heavy metals that are not necessarily screened. My brother moved to Wisconsin, and they moved to a well water system. They had 4 kids. So I said, you got to check your well water. And it turns out he had way, way above recommended doses of manganese in his water. So he was very thankful that they checked that. Head injury, and there's a lot that is in the published literature and in the news recently about head injury and neurologic disease. Parkinson's may be one of them. And we did a study here that was published in the mid-1980s. I think it was Dr. St. Helena and Dr. Myers who were the head of that study. And they looked at all different kinds of risk factors for Parkinson's disease, but the one that clearly fell out was head injury, enough to cause a concussion at some point in the life. In family history, we always get family history, but the truth is that 95% of cases of Parkinson's disease are spontaneous. They're not genetic in origin. So what do I do on physical exam? As a neurologist, I'm finding I'm doing a skin exam. The mental status, typically initially for Parkinson's disease, is normal, but they can have a delay in recall. And so when you see the numbers that 80 to 90% of patients with Parkinson's disease have dementia, it's not necessarily a cortical dementia. It can be a subcortical dementia, where there's a delay in the processing or a delay in the expression. And so this delay in recall can come out. So I don't know how many of you do the Montreal cognitive assessment. I've turned to that instead of the Fullstein for my cognitive exam, especially screening. And there's a recall of 5 words at the end, and they have to come up with the 5 words spontaneously. That's the only way they get points. But you can give them category cues or multiple choice later. And that's where, if they have trouble recalling those 5 words, as soon as you give them a category cue, people with Parkinson's disease can come up with it because you've led them down the path. But that delay in recall is there. Smell is becoming a very important recognized potential risk factor and early sign of Parkinson's disease. I know it is in other diseases as well, but it's really being looked at closely in Parkinson's disease. People have normal eye movements in Parkinson's disease. Hypomimia, or the decreased facial expression. They can have mild dysarthria, and this can be from excess saliva. It can be just from the Parkinson's disease itself. But mild dysarthria can be there. And as a neurologist, we always teach the medical students to check for sternocleid and mastoid strength. But this is where one of the situations where I actually really use cranial nerve 11. Because people with Parkinson's disease, remember, it's asymmetric onset. So you have them shrug their shoulders, and they'll do this. So one shoulder will come up, or the other won't, or there'll be a delay. So that's it's actually quite a sensitive measure of Parkinson's disease and asymmetry. The motor exam, of course, is the key to the exam. Asymmetric findings, tremor mostly at rest, can have a slight action component. Rigidity, and people may need augmentation, so with the other hand, to have them open and close their hand or draw circles, and then you can bring out a little rigidity on the contralateral limb. Bradykinesia, and you want to judge this overall, as well as with finger taps, hand opening, closing, pronation, supination. Toe tap is one of the more sensitive measures in the lower extremities, and heel tap as well. Now, even in people who have normal cognition, they can have frontal release signs, specifically glabellar sign. Not clear why that is, but again, if they have totally normal cognition, cognition that can be there. And the rest of their exam is should be normal, with the exception of gait. And this, to me, is the most important aspect of the neurologic exam in general, but particularly for Parkinson's disease. How well do they stand, particularly without using their arms? Do they need two or three attempts? Can they do it quickly? Watch for their arm swing. Watch for shuffling, of course. That's what everybody looks for. This, if they have no tremor, this is the time where they may actually come out with tremor. Stride length and stride width, and I will remind you that the inner sole of the foot should make a straight line. And so that's a normal width of an exam. What's their posture when they're walking? How do they turn? A normal turn is 1.5 steps. So do they take multiple steps to turn? Or do they even take 3 steps to turn, which is going to be a little bit too much? And a lot of times you may see subtle dystonia that comes out with walking, especially with stress gait. So you have them walk on the outside part of their feet, you may see their arm come up with just a little bit of dystonia. And that arm that you suspect has a little rigidity, and they notice a tremor. And then shoulder pull. And this should be, you should pull, I always have my back against a wall and have the person face away from me. I give them a warning and a little bit of a test. And I tell them, this is what I'm going to do. Take a step back. I'm going to catch you if you fall. And I pull them hard enough that they should take a step or two back. If they clearly retropulse and fall into me, that's not normal. All right, so that was the physical exam. I do want to just show a couple slides related to the DAT scan. This is dopamine transporter, and it's a SPECT scan using a particular ligand. Right now, GE is the only one that has theirs FDA approved because it's chemically related to cocaine. It's going through all kinds of issues through the DEA. Even though there was nothing to suggest any cocaine effects in hundreds, if not thousands, of patients, because it's been available in Europe for many years now. I don't know what the holdup is. Anyway, this is a normal healthy control, and you can see in the basal ganglia that it's nice and symmetric. It's kind of white hot in the middle and fades out to red, and there's these almost comma-shaped highlights of the basal ganglia. So this is someone with early Parkinson's disease, and you can see that even the tail is not quite there as much as the healthy control, and there's some asymmetry. The left side has a little bit more brightness compared to the right. Here's someone with more advanced Parkinson's disease, and you can see there's even less of a signal. It's more diffuse, and so this may be a tool to help differentiate Parkinsonism from other tremors. For example, if someone had tremor and this is what their SPECT scan looks like, it'll make you rethink whether it's Parkinson's disease or not. Now, it's still being worked out in terms of Parkinson's disease versus other Parkinsonisms, because in a known population of Parkinson's disease, 15 to 20% of those patients are going to have a normal SPECT scan, and we don't understand that why. Those are called SWEDs, symptomatic without evidence of dopamine deficiency. I know all kinds of acronyms that they come up with, but either way, 15 to 20% are going to come up normal, but this is what you're going to find in people who clearly have Parkinson's disease and abnormal SPECT imaging. And where are you going to use this? It's really when there's inconclusive Parkinsonism. And so in people who have abnormal SPECT imaging, you're going to lead more toward idiopathic Parkinson's disease or dementia with Lewy bodies. Sometimes these can be very difficult to sort out just from this imaging modality. And if it's negative, then you're going to lead more to essential tremor, vascular Parkinsonism, drug-induced Parkinsonism, or the majority of drugs that are used, or Alzheimer's disease. And this is a good time to point out that up to a third of patients with Alzheimer's disease have Parkinsonism and motor signs consistent with Parkinsonism. That includes up to 10% with tremor, even rest tremor. So Alzheimer's clearly has a motor component to it. In terms of Parkinson's disease, again, these are associated problems early in the disease that I look for, and lack of smell, depression or anxiety, sleep disturbance, and specifically REM sleep behavior disorder, often asking a bed partner, do they talk in their sleep, do they move around, do they fall out of bed even, micrographia, and going back to looking at checkbooks or some type of journal that people write can be good, constipation, and I know that's very nonspecific, it's always something to ask about. Urinary urgency is an interesting one, and I like to document it because often when you initiate treatment, this gets remarkably better. Blurred vision and dry eyes, even though their ophthalmologic examination is totally normal, and people can notice either tearing, and that may be because they're not blinking enough. They can truly have double vision, and so they see things as blurred because their convergence is not so good. But most often people with Parkinson's disease, they have a lack of contrast. So you can see these words because it's white on blue and there's an edge. And people with Parkinson's disease don't see that edge as well. And that comes out in places like the newspaper, which isn't pure black on pure white. It's kind of a dark gray on an off-white. So they may have a harder time reading. Pain in the shoulders and hip, very, very common. I'm not saying everyone with shoulder pain, it's Parkinson's disease. But about 3/4 of people with Parkinson's disease may present with shoulder or hip pain. And that may be because of a partial frozen joint. If you're walking along and you're not swinging your shoulder and you're not using it nearly as much as you should, that can be lead to problems. And dystonia can happen early. Later on, people, almost everyone gets dementia of one sort or another. About 30% will develop a cortical type dementia. Dysphagia, weight loss, autonomic dysfunction in everyone, just a matter of degree, and it's not early. Again, dystonia and drooling. And drooling can be a major issue, not only for cosmetic purposes, but people need to change their shirts sometimes 2 or 3 times a day. I've had people not be able to go to medical daycares because they're drooling and it's a health issue. So that can be addressed sometimes with oral medications, but a little bit of Botox into the salivary glands can work wonders. What causes Parkinson's disease? This we really don't know. And that's kind of the bottom line. We're looking into it. There's a lot that's going on. But as you might expect, it's a probable combination of genetic, toxic, infectious agents, and perhaps others that we don't know. Now, I said that about 95% of cases, there's no genetic component that doesn't run in families. However, first-degree relatives do have about double the lifetime risk of Parkinson's disease. So it goes from about 2% lifetime risk to almost 4%. I'm not talking huge, but significant enough that in many long-term studies, this has panned out. And, of course, the microscopic cause is Lewy body. Just like many other neurodegenerative diseases, there's a lot of debate whether it's the soluble form that's toxic to neurons, or and if that's the case, then are these neurons actually saving others and saving themselves by sequestering this soluble toxic protein, or is it this conglomeration of proteins that's gumming up the works of the cell, and that's what's causing the cell to die off? Right now, there's a lot of debate about that in most neurodegenerative diseases, Parkinson's disease included. But alpha-synuclein is the main component of the Lewy body. Just keeping in mind how to best treat the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, it's still depletion of dopamine in the substantia nigra, this deeper structure that projects up to the striatum. And keep in mind that when people present with Parkinson's disease, they've typically lost about 70% of their dopamine-producing capacity. So this is a process that's been going on for years, sometimes a decade or more, before they walk in the office. So it's important to keep that in mind, especially because people come in and they feel a sense of urgency to do something right then and there. This has been going on for a long time, and I want to make sure that patients are very comfortable with whatever decision it is. So I let them know this has been going on for a long time. There's no urgency if we wait a month or 2 months to make a decision. Now, even though this diagram makes it seem so simple, right, the substantia nigra up to the striatum, there's a lot of connections within the basal ganglia. There are a lot of neurotransmitters. It's not just dopamine. It's not just the substantia nigra. And that's why in this era of multiple dopamine medications that we use to either mimic the action of or to replace dopamine, we're still not treating the symptoms adequately. And so there's a lot of structures and a lot of neurotransmitters that are involved. I'll let you read this and study this on your own time. But the primary pathology, it's very obvious. This black stuff, the substantia nigra, is there in normal, not in people with Parkinson's disease. So that's still what we focus on. This is just a partial list of some of the causes of Parkinsonism to keep in mind when it's not just the substantia nigra that's involved. We already talked about antipsychotic and anti-nausea drugs. Illicit drugs can do it as well, and that's where I think it was a synthetic heroin that caused the Parkinson symptoms, and the MPT, it led to the MPTP animal model of Parkinson's disease. Multiple systems atrophy. Schiedreger has prominent dysautonomia early on. Striatal nigro degeneration, I could explain this as same highway, different direction, because Parkinson's is a nigro striatal degeneration. This is the opposite. It looks very much like Parkinson's disease, a little more dysautonomia, very symmetric, no tremor. Olivopontocerebellar atrophy, Parkinson's, and ataxia. PSP, this is the one that you really need to pay attention to because people do not do as well. The average lifespan for someone with PSP is 9 years. The average time to diagnosis is 5. So they are well within their disease by the time they get properly diagnosed. And all it takes sometimes is looking at vertical saccadic eye movements. That's all it takes to diagnose this sometimes. So people do very poorly with this disease, and it's important in terms of discussing with the family prognosis, and they really do not respond to treatments. Cortical basilar ganglion degeneration, basically it's Parkinsonism with a lot of dystonia, and it can be painful. This one can be painful. The rest of them are not as much. And then there's a whole list of other diseases that usually become more obvious. The one I'd like to point out is normal pressure hydrocephalus. To me, it's the pheochromocytoma of neurology. It's often talked about but rarely found. And it's mentioned so many times in radiologic films, but it's actually quite a rare disorder. But patients come in. They used to come in. It was probably about 2 years ago that it stopped. But Johnson & Johnson was running an ad, I think in the middle of the night, and people about some surgical device for normal pressure hydrocephalus, and they say, do you have Parkinson's disease? You don't have Parkinson's disease. You might have normal pressure hydrocephalus. Talk to your doctor about getting this surgery. And so we had just a flood of people that said, well, I may not have Parkinson's disease, you know. And they had classic Parkinson's disease. I just want to take a little bit of time because this is such a major issue, and it goes back to when James Parkinson described Parkinson's disease. And in the real shaking palsy, the agitation continues full force while the limb is at rest and unemployed, even if sometimes diminished by the causing muscles. So it's mostly a rest tremor that he noted. But he did note that these tremors could be confused with those due to alcohol abuse, tea and coffee abuse, and I think that's still true today, and old age. And I think old age in 1817 was a different criteria. But I think what he was really getting at was essential tremor. And so that's why there's so much effort that goes in to helping to differentiate Parkinson's disease from essential tremor, including the DAT scan. But just to point out some of the differences, Parkinson's is mostly rest tremor. Occasionally, someone with essential tremor might have just a thumb that goes. Parkinson's can have a little action tremor, but this is the hallmark of essential tremor. Tremor frequency is a little lower in Parkinson's disease than in essential tremor, but there can be some overlap. Tremor in Parkinson's disease is often in the extremities, can involve the lip and jaw, and essential tremor extremities, rarely in the legs, almost always in the hands, and cranial as well, so head tremor and vocal tremor. Someone has vocal tremor, they do not have Parkinson's disease. The one exception is if they have prominent chin tremor, then it's going to sound like they have vocal tremor. The progression is years, and at this point, almost years to decades, but clearly it's years to decades in essential tremor. Rigidity, bradykinesia, and response to levodopa are all hallmarks of Parkinson's disease, and people with Parkinson's can have some dystonia, whereas people with essential tremor really don't. So what we would like to do is at some point there's some trigger for the disease, and instead of taking a normal course in terms of functioning, people decline because of their Parkinson's disease, we'd like to delay the progression of the disease and improve their functioning or even reverse their function and get back. But how do we do that? One way to get to a graph like I just showed you was rating Parkinson's disease and getting better measures of how we do that. So right now, we look at Parkinson's disease using the Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale, or the UPDRS. It takes 5 minutes to do. It's really not a hard measure to look at. There was a recent revision addressing some of the issues. The original one was published in 1986, I believe, and it was 2008 when the revised came out, and that's becoming more and more used because we're picking up disease earlier and earlier, and this is more geared for early disease. And the revision also focuses on impact rather than simple presence or absence of symptoms and description of it. So to me, that's also a very important aspect of the MDS UPDRS. They've still divided it up into four parts. There's the non-motor aspects of Parkinson's disease, speech and you know, can you turn in bed, and how's your thinking, and depression and anxiety. And there's a lot. There's a number of questions for the non-motor aspects. Functional assessments, and mostly this is ADLs. Then motor, which is what most people are still using today, although we have to keep everything in mind. And part four is complications of treatment. Freezing, dyskinesias, you know, those movements that Michael J. Fox has so obviously. Okay, so this, what it turns out, after you ask all those questions, too, at the end, there's the modified Honan-Yahr clinical staging. This is probably when people say, well, what stage of disease am I at? A lot of times they're asking about this. And again, you know, if you read through this, this is how we stage disease to get people into clinical trials. They have to have stage three or less. We're talking about the physical exam. We're still talking about 200 years ago type of issues in terms of how to diagnose this. So the original was Hone and Yarrow, was published in 1967. It was revised about 20 years later to add the 1.5 and 2.5. Stage zero is no sign. Stage one is unilateral disease. 1.5 is unilateral plus axial. Stage two is bilateral without impairments of balance. Stage 2.5 is mild bilateral disease with recovery on pull test. So that's the shoulder pull test that I was telling you about. Stage three is mild to moderate bilateral disease, some postural instability, physically independent. Stage four is severe disability, but still able to walk or stand unassisted. And stage five is wheelchair bound or bedridden unless aided. And so clearly there's a lot of play and give in this. There's a lot of stages in between, so sometimes it's very difficult to stage someone, but you know, this is what we have. So that's one clinical stage. This is one example of how we used the motor section of the Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale. This was a study looking at the effect of levodopa. It was called the L-DOPA study, and it was really to show whether it was to answer that age-old question, is levodopa toxic or not when it comes to people? And so they gave people with early Parkinson's disease over about 9 months either a placebo, 150 milligrams worth of levodopa, 300 or 600. And you can see using the Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale that even small changes in their score, and this was about 800 people, about 200 in each group. So we needed a fair amount of people in this study to answer this question. Does levodopa work and is it toxic? It's amazing to me that it took this long to do this. But it's very clear just from using the Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale that we got our answer. It took a long time, and still people are debating. Oh, after 9 months, they took them off, and after 2 weeks, they expected people, if it was toxic, to go worse than placebo. And they noticed that there was really no change. So they said, well, let's assess them 4 weeks after they've stopped levodopa. And there was still essentially no change. So to answer the question of whether levodopa is toxic or not, it's not answered. But some people say, well, it may be neuroprotective. And some people say, well, the effect just lasts longer than we expected in the brain. It's 4 weeks or longer. So now there's L-DOPA 2 that somebody is trying to put together for another few tens of millions of our tax dollars to run. Pathologic staging, I hope that for our patients that we don't have to depend on this. There's not enough in terms of brain banking to take a closer look, but there's still a lot of debate about this. Some people say that it starts in the brainstem and works its way up and then spreads throughout. And dementia with Lewy body, maybe the opposite, that it starts all over and goes back toward the brainstem. So I think that we're about to enter a new era in detection of Parkinson's disease and potentially for neuroprevention as well. So as you've seen, that Parkinson's disease has a preclinical phase. This may be pathologic. It may be just smell, REM sleep behavior disorder. There's a lot that suggests that there's some pathology that's going on. And as I told you, that about 70% of the neurons are lost at the time of diagnosis. So clearly there's a preclinical phase. How do we detect that? We don't really have a way of doing that right now. But there may be potential markers of Parkinson's to detect changes. Biomarkers is the term that's used for this. And potentially interfering with the Parkinson's disease process earlier, maybe even before motor onset, offers the potential for neuroprotection. This is not a new concept. This has been looked at in many different ways. So SPECT imaging, we talked a little bit about. Olfactory testing, there's a big study right now looking at people at higher risk for Parkinson's disease. How's their smell? We track them over 5 years. Different questionnaires, and here's one on constipation. There's others as well. Genetic testing, I know, constipation. As a neurologist, I never thought I'd be doing so much GI work. Transcranial ultrasound, and this is not easy technically, but there are differences in this. You can see the midbrain right here, the Mickey Mouse shape, and so there are differences in the substantia nigra on ultrasound that's been looked at, and cardiac imaging. So the autonomic nervous system has been looked at as a potential biomarker. I'm not going to go into all of these, but just needless to say that there's been a lot that's been looked at for potential biomarkers. And it's important because if every study is going to use the UPDRS and it takes 800 people to enroll and 5-6 years to get that study done, and most drugs fail, what's the incentive for pharmaceutical companies to move forward with development for a devastating disease that affects a million people today that costs us $25 billion? So there's not a whole lot of incentive, and more companies are looking at other diseases that are a little bit of a quicker fix. Getting new drugs to market from discovery to commercialization is 12 years. This is 7 years and longer for neurologic diseases in terms of the studies. And so if we can shorten this by getting a good biomarker, then companies are going to be more likely to move forward. So I just want to, I have a few more minutes, and I just want to talk about the Parkinson's Progression Markers Initiative, the PPMI study, that's being funded and run by the Michael J. Fox Foundation. So the natural history of Parkinson's disease, if you look at neuronal function, at some point it declines and people become symptomatic, and then they get diagnosed and they continue to decline. If you look at the clinical rating scale, there's 0, 0, 0, and then they increase at some point, and usually there's a ceiling effect. So PPMI is really focused on this stage. When people are symptomatic, they've been diagnosed, there's some evidence on clinical rating, but the neuronal function is not declined as far as it's going to go. So the way this is a slide that I also like to give to a general audience, not just physicians, but that telltale signs, biomarkers are telltale signs that reveal otherwise hidden information from deep within your body. I think that's a very good concept. And we do this for a lot of diseases. Blood glucose in urine is a biomarker for diabetes, for example. Wouldn't it be great if you could pee in a cup and you could know how your Parkinson's was doing? That's a lot better than how fast your finger tapping or what James Parkinson's described 200 years ago. So we've already been through this in terms of the early associated problems, but keep that in mind, because these are the questionnaire. This is what we're focusing on in terms of the physical exam and the questionnaires as we're assessing early Parkinson's disease. So as I've said, the clinical trial design requires large sample sizes, 800 people, sometimes more, and long duration, many years. And so this is a barrier for pharmaceutical companies, high cost. And the UPDRS is a very good clinical measure for when someone comes in the clinic, I do the UPDRS, I see them a year later, I can see where things were the year before, but it's not a very reliable and efficient mechanism when it comes to developing new drugs. There's too much variation between providers, even though it's the best of what we have. So right now there's no validated biomarker for Parkinson's disease. And here's just off the web from the PPMI study. There's been a large campaign. I don't know if you've seen any of the stuff coming through the BMC, and I was on a couple of the local papers and things. So what it is, it's an observational multi-center trial study to assess the progression of clinical features, imaging, and biologic markers in Parkinson's subjects and healthy controls. So this is one of the first times that people with family members or friends who have Parkinson's disease can actually participate and move forward with the development of research and potentially treatments for Parkinson's disease. So again, the goal is to find and measure and diagnose and track Parkinson's disease better. Find a measure to diagnose and track Parkinson's disease better. Hopefully that's going to lower the cost and speed treatment, which of course Michael J. Fox is all about, finding a cure today. It's going to recruit 400 people with Parkinson's disease, 400. So it's a huge study. It's 18 centers internationally. We are one of the sites. Right now, other than Institute for Neurodegenerative Disease in Connecticut, we're the only New England site. And 200 controls, so 600 people. And the reason this was chosen, they had to start somewhere. And this right now is a pretty typical number for a phase two study. And they did this on purpose because statistically, this is a very difficult observational study to develop because it's casting a very broad net. And they wanted to simulate the numbers that a pharmaceutical company might use in a phase two trial so that they can look at what's validated in this study and move forward with a trial. Standardized protocols are used across all 18 sites, and this is the first time that for certain aspects of measuring Parkinson's disease that there really is a standardized protocol that's being set up. Samples are going to be analyzed and stored at core facilities. This includes the clinical measures, and it's going to be publicly available real-time. So if you have an interest in looking at falls in Parkinson's, in early Parkinson's disease, for example, this is going to be open as long as it's a scientifically valid and ethical study. It's out there to be used. And so there's going to be biological samples, and people need to be free from medications for at least 6 months. There are some people that say, well, with all the data on risagiline, which is Azelect, that it's a potentially neuroprotective agent. How can you keep people medication-free for 6 months? Well, first of all, I think the data is, there's only one study, and it's very mixed in terms of that data. Why 1 milligram but not half or 2 milligrams in terms of risagiline? But the other is that most people in early Parkinson's disease can tolerate 6 months, a year and a half of not being on treatment. And the other argument that I have for this that makes it okay is that this is a process that's been going on for years. And so 6 months, as long as people know that there are risks of functional decline over that 6 months, I think that's something that they should feel free to take. But in early Parkinson's disease, I don't see this as an issue. Some people have raised it. So people are assessed at baseline and every 3 months for a year, and then it's every 6 months. And then we're going to be doing, as the revised UPDRS, an extensive battery of neuropsychiatric and cognitive testing in this population. Sleep and sleepiness assessments and olfaction, the UPSIT, the University of Pennsylvania smell test. Imaging, DAT scan is going to be part of it. In fact, they're using it as a screening criteria. In order to be in the control group, you have to have a normal DAT scan. In order to be in the Parkinson's group, you have to have an abnormal DAT scan with asymmetry. And everyone's getting an MRI. There's a subset that are getting diffusion tensor imaging, which basically just tells us about the white matter paths in the brain. But not everyone is getting that. And biological fluids are going to be collected, blood, CSF, urine, and DNA. So what I hope is that instead of what James Parkinson's description in 1817, we're going to be moving toward this description of Parkinson's disease. In an individual at risk genetically and environmentally, the syndrome of REM sleep behavior disorder, anosmia, constipation with an abnormal DAT scan was monitored using levels of urate, alpha-synuclein, and we held back the symptom progression with. To be continued. So thank you very much for your time and attention, and I think we have time for questions.
So you sort of implied, although I don't think you said explicitly, that the other part of diagnosis, or the clinical diagnosis, is response to dopamine replacement therapy. And I'm curious about those SWED populations.
Yeah.
About 15-20% of patients who have clinical idiopathic Parkinson's disease but have normal dopamine on their DAT scan. Do they respond to dopamine replacement therapy?
So to answer the first question, I'm a little uncomfortable using levodopa replacement therapy as a diagnostic tool. And the reason is that the sooner you start levodopa, the sooner you're setting the clock for starting motor complications. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. And if people are functionally impaired, they certainly need some treatment. But there was a study looking at early Parkinson's disease, starting people on either levodopa or pramipexole. And they followed them, and this was a study published a couple years ago now. It's the CALM cohort. And after 6 years, there was no difference in quality of life. There was no difference in function, whether you started on levodopa or pramipexole. But people who were started on levodopa had much higher rate of motor complications. And this we knew, but this was a study that just validated it. And so as soon as you start levodopa, you start the clock for motor complications. And dyskinesias, although we don't necessarily, people may not necessarily notice them, they can be bothersome to them. So anything that I can do as a physician to delay the onset of dyskinesias or other motor complications, I'd like to do that. I think that we just don't have the long-term data to say that, but even one dose of levodopa can set you up for longer-term complications later on. Again, it's the right thing to do in many populations and in the right patients. So I'm not saying never do it, but as a diagnostic tool, that's not something that I do. I think a little tincture of thyme is a little better than a few hundred milligrams of levodopa. In terms of the SWEDs, we're still trying to understand this. And that's one of the reasons that those patients are excluded from participating in this trial, because we don't understand it right now. There are the cynical who say that, well, it's just investigators who, you know, want money, and so they enroll people who they think might have Parkinson's disease, and that's why they're SWEDs. But I think that it's more to it than that. I think that the Parkinson's is just a more complex disorder than we really know, and it gets down to more than just what the dopamine receptors are doing in this striatum. I think it has to do with other neurotransmitters and dopamine in other aspects of the brain and other responses to dopamine. So I don't think that we understand those sweats yet, but it's a very interesting phenomenon.
Do you know if they respond to treatment?
Yeah, so they are, by everything that we know of clinically, are classic Parkinson's disease, and they respond to the treatments, and they really do. Now, there is a higher proportion of those people that go on to develop a Parkinsonian disorder rather than strictly Parkinson's disease, so higher incidence of multiple system atrophy or progressive supranuclear palsy, for example. But some of those people stay as idiopathic, run-of-the-mill Parkinson's disease, and they have a typical clinical course. And those people we really just don't understand. I'm sorry.
Somebody have a question?
Oh, okay.
So another question about the DAT scan. So right now it's a research tool. But I saw down there at the bottom, you know, perhaps being approved for clinical use. I was a little skeptical about like new technology and what value it adds. So what would it add to clinical evaluation at this point?
Well, so it is FDA approved. I will tell you that the FDA has approved it as a diagnostic tool to differentiate mostly Parkinsonism from essential tremor. And that's not a minor consideration, because there are some people with essential tremor that, unless they fully, really, truly relax their arms, they're going to have tremor. And so people can be confused. Ben Wolosin, I don't know if he's come and talked to you, he's one of our basic researchers and does a lot of epidemiologic study with VA data. He looked at 8 million vets with and their medication use. And it turns out that in people with the diagnosis of Parkinsonism, one of the most common medications that's used is propranolol. Now, propranolol is one of the main medications that we use for tremor and essential tremor. And so clearly in that population, they were getting medications that didn't work for them if they truly had Parkinson's disease and could potentially cause some harm. So to me, to prevent people from getting just thrown on a dozen different medications to see, well, let's see what works. And that'll help us to decide what the diagnosis is. I think that's where that scan can play a role. If you're, I'm a little biased because I have people that have already been tried on different medications, may have already been seen by 1, 2, 3 neurologists, and they're coming for another opinion what they may have. But to me, when I just spend a little time and I talk with patients and I do a more detailed exam, to me, it becomes much more obvious whether they have Parkinson's disease or not. But I think if you have 5 minutes to decide if someone has a neurodegenerative disease or essential tremor, unfortunately, in our day and age, it's a lot easier to order a test, and I hate to put it that way. But, I mean, I don't feel that way personally, but again, I have a biased population. But I can see why if someone comes in with any kind of tremor, slowness, even falls, that they're going to be sent off not for an MRI but for a DAT scan. When, in fact, spending half an hour with them would do the same thing. So I'm pretty skeptical in terms of the use, but you know, that's my own bias. But I do think that it's going to have a role in some patients.